Eddie was shaking his head numbly before he realized this was another mistake. Henry's smile broadened.
"Well, that's okay," he said. "I don't mind taking you one by one. Come on down here, asshole."
Victor stood beside Henry. Patrick Hochstetter trailed behind them, smiling in a porky, vacant way Eddie was familiar with from school. Moose was still getting up.
"Come on, asshole," Henry said. "Let's talk about throwing rocks. Let's talk about that. You wanna?"
Now that it was too late, Eddie decided it would be wise to go back into the store. Back in the store where there was a grown-up. But as he retreated, Henry darted forward and grabbed him. He pulled Eddie's arm, pulled hard, his smile turning into a snarl. Eddie's hand was ripped free of the screen door. He was pulled off the steps and would have crashed headlong into the gravel if Victor hadn't caught him roughly under the arms. Victor threw him. Eddie managed to keep on his feet, but only by whirling around twice. The four boys faced him now over a distance of about 10 feet, Henry slightly ahead of the others, smiling. His hair stood up at the back in a cowlick. Behind Henry and on his left was Patrick Hochstetter, a genuinely spooky kid. Eddie hadn't ever seen him with anyone else until today. He was just enough overweight so that his belly always hung slightly over his belt, which had a red rider buckle. His face was perfectly round and usually as pale as cream. Now he had a slight sunburn. It was heaviest on his nose, which was peeling, but it spread out toward either cheek like wings. In school, Patrick liked to kill flies with his green plastic school-time ruler and put them in his pencil box. Sometimes he would show his fly collection to some new kid in the play yard at recess, his heavy lips smiling, his gray-green eyes sober and thoughtful. He never spoke when he exhibited his dead flies, no matter what the new kid might say to him. That expression was on his face now.
"How you doing, Rock Man?" Henry asked, advancing across the distance between them. "Got any rocks on you?"
"Leave me alone," Eddie said in a trembling voice.
"Leave me alone," Henry mimicked, waving his hands in mock terror.
Victor laughed.
"What are you going to do if I don't, Rock Man, huh?"
His hand flashed out incredibly fast and exploded against Eddie's cheek with a gunshot sound. Eddie's head rocked back. Tears began to pour from his left eye.
"My friends are inside," Eddie said.
"My friends are inside," Patrick Hochstetter squealed.
"Oh, oh, oh."
He began to circle to Eddie's right. Eddie started to turn in that direction. Henry's hand flashed out again, and this time his other cheek flamed.
"Don't cry," he thought. "That's what they want. But don't you do it, Eddie. Bill wouldn't do it. Bill wouldn't cry. And don't you cry either."
Victor stepped forward and gave Eddie a hard, open-handed push in the middle of his chest. Eddie stumbled half a step backward and then fell sprawling over Patrick, who had crouched directly behind his feet. He thudded to the gravel, scraping his arms. There was a woof as the wind rushed out of him. A moment later, Henry Bowers was on top of him, his knees pinning Eddie's arms, his butt on Eddie's stomach.
"Got any rocks, Rock Man?"
Henry raved down at him, and Eddie was more frightened by the mad light in Henry's eyes than he was by the pain in his arms or by his inability to get his breath back. Henry was nuts. Somewhere close by, Patrick tittered.
"You want to throw rocks, huh? I'll give you rocks. Here, here's some rocks."
Henry swept up a handful of gravel and slammed it down into Eddie's face. He rubbed the gravel into Eddie's skin, cutting his cheeks, his eyelids, his lips. Eddie opened his mouth and screamed.
"Want rocks? I'll give you rocks. Here's some rocks, Rock Man. You want rocks? Okay, okay, okay."
Gravel slammed into his open mouth, lacerating his gums, grinding against his teeth. He felt sparks fly against his fillings. He screamed again and spat gravel out.
"Want some more rocks? Okay. How about a few more? How about..."
"Stop that. Here, here. Stop that, you boy. Quit on him. Right now, you hear me? Quit on him." Through half-lidded, tear-blurred eyes, Eddie saw a big hand come down and grab Henry by the collar of his shirt and the right strap of his bibballs. The hand gave a yank, and Henry was pulled off. He landed in the gravel and got up. Eddie rose more slowly. He was trying to scramble to his feet, but his scrambler seemed temporarily broken. He gasped and spat chunks of bloody gravel out of his mouth. It was Mr. Guidreau, dressed in his long white apron, and he looked furious. There was no fear in his face, although Henry stood about 3 inches taller and probably outweighed him by 50 pounds. There was no fear in his face because he was the grown-up and Henry was the kid. Except this time, Eddie thought, that might not mean anything. Mr. Guidreau didn't understand. He didn't understand that Henry was nuts.
You get out of here, Mr. Guidreau said, advancing on Henry until he stood toe-to-toe with the hulking, sullen-faced boy. You get out, and you don't want to come back either. I don't hold with bullying. I don't hold with four against one. What would your mothers think?
He swept the others with his hot, angry eyes. Moose and Victor dropped their gazes and examined their sneakers.
Patrick only stared at and through Mr. Guidreau with that vacant gray-green look.
Mr. Guidreau looked back at Henry and got just as far as, You get on your bikes and...
When Henry gave him a good hard push, an expression of surprise that would have been comical in other circumstances spread across Mr. Guidreau's face as he flew backward, loose gravel spurting out from under his heels.
He struck the steps leading up to the screen door and sat down hard.
Why, you, he began.
Henry's shadow fell on him.
Get inside, he said.
You,
Mr. Guidreau said, and this time he stopped on his own.
Mr. Guidreau had finally seen it, Eddie realized, the light in Henry's eyes. He got up quickly, apron flapping. He went up the stairs as fast as he could, stumbling on the second one from the top and going briefly to one knee. He was up again at once, but that stumble, as brief as it had been, seemed to rob him of the rest of his grown-up authority. He spun around at the top and yelled, I'm calling the cops. Henry made as if to lunge for him, and Mr. Guidreau flinched back.
That was the end, Eddie realized. As incredible, as unthinkable as it seemed, there was no protection for him here.
It was time to go. While Henry was standing at the bottom of the steps and glaring up at Mr. Guidreau, and while the others were staring, transfixed, and, except for Patrick Hockstetter, not a little horrified, by this sudden, successful defiance of adult authority, Eddie saw his chance. He whirled, took to his heels, and ran. He was halfway up the block before Henry turned, his eyes blazing.
Get him,
he bellowed. Asthma or no asthma, Eddie ran them a good race that day. There were spaces, some of them as long as 50 feet, when he couldn't remember if the soles of his PF Flyers had touched the sidewalk or not. For a few moments, he even entertained the giddy notion that he might be able to outrun them. Then, just before he reached Kansas Street and what might have been safety, a little kid on a trike suddenly pedaled out of a driveway and right into Eddie's path. Eddie tried to swerve, but running full out as he had been, he might have done better to jump over the kid. The kid's name, in fact, was Richard Cohen, and he would grow up, marry, and father a son named Frederick Cohen, who would be drowned in a toilet and then be partially eaten by a thing that rose up from the toilet like black smoke and then took an unthinkable shape. Or at least to try. One of Eddie's feet caught on the trike's back deck, where an adventurous little shit might stand and push the trike along like a scooter. Richard Cohen, whose unborn son would be murdered by it 27 years later, barely rocked on his trike. Eddie, however, went flying. He struck the sidewalk on his shoulder, rebounded, came down again, and skidded 10 feet, erasing the skin from his elbows and knees. He was trying to get up when Henry Bowers hit him like a shell from a bazooka and knocked him flat. Eddie's nose connected briskly with the concrete. Blood flew. Henry did a quick side roll like a paratrooper and was up again. He grabbed Eddie by the nape of the neck and by his right wrist. His breath, snorting through his swelled and splinted nose, was warm and moist.
Want rocks, Rockman? Sure, shit.
He jerked Eddie's wrist halfway up his back.
Eddie yelled. Rocks for the Rockman, right, Rockman?
He jerked Eddie's wrist up even higher. Eddie screamed. Behind him, dimly, he could hear the others approaching and the little kid on the trike starting to bawl.
Join the club, kid, he thought,
and in spite of the pain, in spite of the tears and the fear, he brayed a huge donkey-like hee-haw of laughter.
You think this is funny?
Henry asked, sounding suddenly astounded rather than furious.
You think this is funny?
And did Henry also sound scared?
Years later, Eddie would think, yes, scared. He sounded scared.
Eddie twisted his wrist in Henry's grip. He was slick with sweat, and he almost got away. Perhaps that was why Henry shoved Eddie's wrist up harder this time than before. Eddie heard a crack in his arm like the sound of winter wood giving under an accumulated plate of ice. The pain that rolled out of his fractured arm was gray and huge. He shrieked, but the sound seemed distant. The color was washing out of the world, and when Henry let go of him and pushed, he seemed to float toward the sidewalk. It took a long time to get down to that old sidewalk. He had a good look at every single crack in it as he glided down. He had a chance to admire the way the July sun glinted off the flecks of mica in that old sidewalk.
He had a chance to note the remains of a very old hopscotch grid that had been done in pink chalk on that old sidewalk. Then, for just a moment, it swam and looked like something else. It looked like a turtle. He might have fainted then, but he struck on his newly broken arm, and this fresh pain was sharp, bright, hot, terrible. He felt the splintered ends of the green stick fracture grind together. He bit his tongue, bringing fresh blood. He rolled over on his back and saw Henry, Victor, Moose, and Patrick standing over him. They looked impossibly tall, impossibly high up, like pallbearers peering into a grave.
"You like that, Rock Man?"
Henry asked, his voice drifting down over a distance, floating through clouds of pain.
"You like that action, Rock Man? You like that Jabba Nabba?"
Patrick Hockstetter giggled.
"Your father's crazy,"
Eddie heard himself say,
"and so are you."
Henry's grin faded so fast it might have been slapped off his face. He drew his foot back to kick, and then a siren rose in the still hot afternoon. Henry paused. Victor and Moose looked around uneasily.
"Henry, I think we'd better get out of here," Moose said.
"I know damn well I'm getting out of here," Victor said. How far away their voices seemed, like the clown's balloons. They seemed to float.
Victor took off toward the library, cutting into McCarran Park to get off the street. Henry hesitated a moment longer, perhaps hoping the cop car was on some other business and he could continue with his own. But the siren rose again, closer.
"You got lucky, fuckface," he said.
He and Moose took off after Victor. Patrick Hockstetter waited for a moment.
"Here's a little something extra for you,"
he whispered in his low, husky voice. He inhaled and spat a large green lunger into Eddie's upturned, sweating, bloody face. Splat!
"Don't eat it all at once if you don't want,"
Patrick said, smiling his liverish, unsettling smile.
"Save some for later if you want."
Then he turned slowly and was also gone. Eddie tried to wipe the lunger off with his good arm, but even that little movement made the pain flare again.
"Now, when you started off for the drugstore, you never thought you'd end up on the Costello Avenue sidewalk with a busted arm and Patrick Hockstetter's snot running down your face, did you? You never even got to drink your Pepsi. Life's full of surprises, isn't it?"
Incredibly, he laughed again. It was a weak sound, and it hurt his broken arm to laugh, but it felt good. And there was something else. No asthma. His breathing was okay, at least for now. A good thing, too. He never would have been able to get to his aspirator. Never in 1,000 years. The siren was very close now, whooping and whooping. Eddie closed his eyes and saw red under his eyelids. Then the red turned black as a shadow fell over him. It was the little kid with the trike.
"You okay?"
the little kid asked.
"Do I look okay?" Eddie asked.
"No, you look terrible," the little kid said, and pedaled off singing "The Farmer in the Dell."
Eddie began to giggle. Here was the cop car. He could hear the squeal of its brakes. He found himself hoping vaguely that Mr. Nell would be in it, even though he knew Mr. Nell was a foot patrolman.
"Why in the name of God are you giggling?"
He didn't know, any more than he knew why he should feel, in spite of the pain, such intense relief. Was it maybe just because he was still alive that the worst he had suffered was a broken arm, and there were still some pieces to pick up? He settled for that. But years later, sitting in the dairy library with a glass of gin and prune juice in front of him and his aspirator near at hand, he told the others he thought it was something more than that. He had been old enough to feel that something more, but not to understand or define it.
"I think it was the first real pain I ever felt in my life,"
he would tell the others.
"It wasn't what I thought it would be at all. It didn't put an end to me as a person. I think it gave me a basis for comparison, finding out you could still exist inside the pain, in spite of the pain."
Eddie turned his head weakly to the right and saw large black Firestone tires, blinding chrome hubcaps, and pulsing blue lights. He heard Mr. Nell's voice then, thickly Irish, impossibly Irish, more like Richie's Irish cop voice than Mr. Nell's real voice. But perhaps that was the distance.
"Holy Jesus, it's the Casbrack Bay."
At this point, Eddie floated away. 4. And, with one exception, stayed away for quite a while. There was a brief period of consciousness in the ambulance. He saw Mr. Nell sitting across from him, tipping a drink from his little brown bottle and reading a paperback called "I, the Jury." The girl on the cover had the biggest bosoms Eddie had ever seen. His eyes shifted past Mr. Nell to the driver up front.
The driver peered around at Eddie with a big, leering grin, his skin livid with grease paint and talcum powder, his eyes shiny as new quarters. It was Pennywise.
Mr. Nell,
Eddie husked. Mr. Nell looked up and smiled.
How are you feeling, me by?
Driver, the driver.
Yes, we'll be there in a jig,
Mr. Nell said, and handed him the little brown bottle.
Suck some of this, it'll make you feel better.
Eddie drank what tasted like liquid fire. He coughed, hurting his arm. He looked toward the front and saw the driver again. Just some guy with a crew cut, no clown. He drifted off again. Much later, there was the emergency room and a nurse wiping blood and dirt and snot and gravel off his face with a cold cloth. It stung, but it felt wonderful at the same time. He heard his mother bugling and clarioning outside, and he tried to tell the nurse not to let her in, but no words would come out, no matter how hard he tried.
If he's dying, I want to know,
his mother was bellowing.
You hear me? It's my right to know, and it's my right to see him. I can sue you, you know. I know lawyers, plenty of lawyers. Some of my best friends are lawyers.
Don't try to talk, the nurse said to Eddie. She was young, and he could feel her bosoms pressing against his arm. For a moment, he had this crazy idea that the nurse was Beverly Marsh, and then he drifted away again. When he came back, his mother was in the room, talking to Dr. Handor at a mile-a-minute clip. Sonia Kasprak was a huge woman. Her legs encased in support hose were trunk-like, but weirdly smooth. Her face was pale now, except for hectic, flaring blots of rouge.
Ma,
Eddie managed.
All right, I'm all right.
You're not, Mrs. Kasprak moaned. She wrung her hands. Eddie heard her knuckles crack and grind. He began to feel his breath shorten up as he looked at her, seeing what a state she was in, how this latest escapade of his had hurt her. He wanted to tell her to take it easy or she'd have a heart attack, but he couldn't. His throat was too dry.
You're not all right. You've had a serious accident, a very serious accident. But you will be all right. I promise you that, Eddie. You will be all right, even if we need to bring in every specialist in the book. Oh, Eddie, Eddie, your poor arm.
She burst into honking sobs. Eddie saw that the nurse who had washed his face was looking at her without much sympathy. All through this aria, Dr. Handor had been stuttering, Sonia, please, Sonia, Sonia. He was a skinny, limp-looking man with a little mustache that hadn't grown very well and which, in addition, had been clipped unevenly, so it was longer on the left side than on the right. He looked nervous. Eddie remembered what Mr. Keene had told him that morning and felt a certain sorrow for Dr. Handor. At last, gathering himself, Russ Handor managed to say, If you can't control yourself, you'll have to leave, Sonia. She whirled on him, and he drew back.
I'll do no such thing. Don't you even suggest it. This is my son lying here in agony. My son lying here on his bed of pain.
Eddie astounded them all by finding his voice.
I want you to leave, Ma. If they're going to do something that'll make me yell, and I think they are, you'll feel better if you go.
She turned to him, astonished and hurt. At the sight of the hurt on her face, he felt his chest begin to tighten down inexorably.
I certainly will not, she cried. What an awful thing to say, Eddie. You're delirious. You don't understand what you're saying. That's the only explanation.
I don't know what the explanation is, and I don't care, the nurse said. All I know is that we're standing here doing nothing while we should be setting your son's arm.
Are you suggesting?
Sonia began, her voice rising toward the high, bugling note it took on when she was most upset.
Please, Sonia, Dr. Handor said. Let's not have an argument here. Let's help Eddie.
Sonia stood back, but her glowering eyes, the eyes of a mother bear whose cub has been threatened, promised the nurse that there would be trouble later, possibly even a suit. Then her eyes misted, extinguishing the glower, or at least hiding it. She took Eddie's good hand and squeezed it so painfully that he winced.
It's bad, but you'll be well again soon, she said. Well again soon, I promise you that.
Sure, Ma,
Eddie wheezed.
Could I have my aspirator?
Of course, she said. Sonia Kasprak looked at the nurse triumphantly, as if vindicated of some ridiculous criminal charge.
My son has asthma, she said. It's quite serious, but he copes with it beautifully.
Good, the nurse said flatly. His Ma held the aspirator for him so he could inhale. A moment later, Dr. Handor was feeling Eddie's broken arm. He was as gentle as possible, but the pain was still enormous.
Eddie felt like screaming and gritted his teeth against it.
He was afraid if he screamed, his mother would scream too. Sweat stood out on his forehead in large, clear drops.
You're hurting him, Mrs. Kasprak said. I know you are. There's no need of that. Stop it. There's no need for you to hurt him. He's very delicate. He can't stand that sort of pain.
Eddie saw the nurse lock her furious eyes with Dr. Handor's tired, worried ones. He saw the wordless conversation that passed between them.
Send that woman out of here, doctor.
And in the drop of his eyes,
I can't. I don't dare.
There was great clarity inside the pain. Although, in truth, this was not a clarity that Eddie would want to experience often. The price was too high. And in that unspoken conversation, Eddie accepted everything Mr. Keene had told him. His hydrox aspirator was filled with nothing more than flavored water. The asthma wasn't in his throat or his chest or his lungs, but in his head. Somehow or other, he was going to have to deal with that truth. He looked at his mother, seeing her clear in his pain. Each flower on her Lane Bryant dress, the sweat stains under her arms where the pads she wore had soaked through, the scuff marks on her shoes. He saw how small her eyes were in their pockets of flesh, and now a terrible thought came to him. Those eyes were almost predatory, like the eyes of the leper that had crawled out of the basement at 29 Niebolt Street.
Here I come, that's all right. It won't do you any good to run, Eddie.
Dr. Handor put his hands gently around Eddie's broken arm and squeezed. The pain exploded. Eddie drifted away. 5. They gave him some liquid to drink, and Dr. Handor set the fracture. He heard Dr. Handor telling his ma that it was a greenstick fracture, no more serious than any childhood break. It's the sort of break kids get falling out of trees, he said, and Eddie heard his ma respond furiously, Eddie doesn't climb trees. Now I want the truth. How bad is he? Then the nurse was giving him a pill. He felt her bosoms against his shoulder again and was grateful for their comforting pressure. Even through the haze, he could see that the nurse was angry, and he thought, he said,
she's not the leper. Please don't think that. She's only eating me because she loves me.
But perhaps nothing came out because the nurse's angry face didn't change. He had a faint recollection of being pushed up a corridor in a wheelchair and his mother's voice somewhere behind, fading,
what do you mean, visiting hours? Don't talk to me about visiting hours. That's my son.
Fading. He was glad she was fading, glad he was fading. The pain was gone and the clarity was gone with it. He didn't want to think. He wanted to drift. He was aware that his right arm felt very heavy. He wondered if they had put it in a cast yet. He couldn't seem to see if they had or not. He was vaguely aware of radios playing from rooms, of patients who looked like ghosts in their hospital johnnies walking up and down the wide halls, and that it was hot, so very hot. When he was wheeled into his room, he could see the sun going down in an angry orange boil of blood and thought incoherently,
like a great big clown button.
Come on, Eddie, you can walk, a voice was saying, and he found that he could. He was slid between crisp, cool sheets. The voice told him that he would have some pain in the night, but not to ring for a painkiller unless it got very bad. Eddie asked if he could have a drink of water. The water came with a straw that had an accordion middle so you could bend it. It was cool and good. He drank it all. There was pain in the night, a good deal of it. He lay awake in bed, holding the call button in his left hand, but not pressing it. A thunderstorm was going on outside, and when the lightning flashed blue-white, he turned his head away from the windows, afraid he might see a monstrous grinning face etched across the sky in that electric fire. At last he slept again, and in his sleep he had a dream. In it he saw Bill, Ben, Richie, Stan, Mike, and Bev, his friends, arriving at the hospital on their bikes. Bill was riding Richie double on Silver. He was surprised to see that Beverly was wearing a dress. It was a lovely green, the color of the Caribbean in a National Geographic plate. He couldn't remember if he had ever seen her in a dress before. All he remembered were jeans and pedal pushers and what the girls called school sets. Skirts and blouses. The blouses usually white with round collars, the skirts usually brown and pleated and hemmed at mid-shin so that the scabs on their knees didn't show. In the dream, he saw them coming in for the 2 p.m. visiting hours, and his mother, who had been waiting patiently since 11, shouting so loudly at them that everyone turned to look at her.
If you think you're going in there, you've got another think coming,
Eddie's mother shouted. And now the clown, who had been sitting here in the waiting room all along, but way back in one corner, with a copy of Look magazine held up in front of his face until now,
jumped up and mimed applause, patting his white-gloved hands together rapidly. He capered and danced, now turning a cartwheel, now executing a neat back-over flip, as Mrs. Kasprak ranted at Eddie's fellow losers, and as they shrank, one by one, behind Bill, who only stood there, pale but outwardly calm, his hands stuffed deep into the pockets of his jeans. Maybe so no one, including Bill himself, would be able to see if they were shaking or not. No one saw the clown except Eddie. Although a baby who had been sleeping peacefully in his mother's arms awoke and began to cry lustily.
"You've done enough damage," Eddie's ma shouted. "I know who those boys were. They've been in trouble at school. They've even been in trouble with the police. And just because those boys have something against you is no reason for them to have something against him. I told him so, and he agrees with me. He wants me to tell you to go away. He's done with you. He never wants to see any of you again. He doesn't want your so-called friendship anymore, any of you. I knew it would lead to trouble, and look at this. My Eddie in the hospital, a boy as delicate as he is."
The clown capered and jumped and did splits and stood on one hand. Its smile was real enough now, and in his dream Eddie realized that this was, of course, what the clown wanted, a nice big wedge to drive among them, splitting them apart and destroying any chance of concerted action. In a kind of filthy ecstasy, the clown did a double barrel roll and burlesqued kissing his mother's cheek.
"Those boys who did it," Bill began.
"Don't you speak back to me," Mrs. Kasprak shrieked.
"Don't you dare speak back to me. He's done with you, I say. Done."
Then an intern came running into the waiting room and told Eddie's ma she would have to be quiet or leave the hospital. The clown started to fade, started to wash out. And as it did, it began to change. Eddie saw the leper, the mummy, the bird. He saw the werewolf and the vampire whose teeth were Gillette blue blades set at crazy angles like mirrors in a carnival mirror maze. He saw Frankenstein, the creature, and something fleshy and shell-like that opened and closed like a mouth. He saw a dozen other terrible things, 100. But just before the clown washed out completely, he saw the most terrible thing of all. His ma's face.
"No," he tried to scream. "No, no, not her, not my ma."
But no one looked around. No one heard. And in the dream's fading moments, he realized with a cold and wormy horror that they couldn't hear him. He was dead. It had killed him, and he was dead. He was a ghost. 6. Sonia Kasprak's sour-sweet triumph at sending Eddie's so-called friends away evaporated almost as soon as she stepped into Eddie's private room the next afternoon on the 21st of July. She could not tell exactly why the feeling of triumph should fade like that, or why it should be displaced by an unfocused fear. It was something in her son's pale face, which was not blurred with pain or anxiety, but instead bore an expression she could not remember ever having seen there before. It was sharp somehow, sharp and alert and set. The confrontation between Eddie's friends and Eddie's ma had not occurred in the waiting room, as in Eddie's dream. She had known they would be coming. Eddie's friends, who were probably teaching him to smoke cigarettes in spite of his asthma. His friends, who had such an unhealthy hold over him that they were all he talked about when he came home for the evening. His friends who got his arm broken. She had told all this to Mrs. Van Pratt next door. "The time has come," Mrs. Kasprak had said grimly, "to slap a few cards down on the table." Mrs. Van Pratt, who had horrible skin problems and who could almost always be counted upon to agree eagerly, almost pathetically, with everything Sonia Kasprak said, in this case had the temerity to disagree.
"I should think you'd be glad he's made some friends," Mrs. Van Pratt said as they hung out their washes in the early morning cool before work.
This had been during the first week of July.
"And he's safer if he's with other children, Mrs. Kasprak, don't you think so? With all that's going on in this town, and all the poor children that have been murdered?"
Mrs. Kasprak's only reply had been an angry sniff. In fact, she couldn't just then think of an adequate verbal response, although she thought of dozens, some of them extremely cutting, later on. And when Mrs. Van Pratt called her that evening, sounding rather anxious, to ask if Mrs. Kasprak would be going to the Beano down at St. Mary's with her like usual, Mrs. Kasprak had replied coldly that she believed she would just stay home that evening and put her feet up instead. Well, she hoped Mrs. Van Pratt was satisfied now. She hoped Mrs. Van Pratt saw now that the only danger abroad in Derry this summer wasn't the sex maniac killing children and babies. Here was her son, lying on his bed of pain in Derry Home Hospital. He might never be able to use his good right arm again. She had heard of such things, or, God forbid, loose splinters from the break might work through his bloodstream to his heart and puncture it and kill him. Oh, of course, God would never allow that to happen, but she had heard of it happening, so that meant God could allow such a thing to happen, in certain cases. So she lingered on the home hospital's long and shady front porch, knowing they would show up, coldly determined to put paid to this so-called friendship, this camaraderie that ended in broken arms and beds of pain, once and for all. Eventually they came, as she had known they would, and to her horror she saw that one of them was a nigger. Not that she had anything against niggers. She thought they had every right to ride where they wanted to on the buses down south and eat at white lunch counters and should not be made to sit in nigger heaven at the movies unless they bothered white women, people. But she also believed firmly in what she called the bird theory. Blackbirds flew with other blackbirds, not with the robins. Grackles roosted with grackles. They did not mix in with the bluebirds or the nightingales. To each his own was her motto. And seeing Mike Hanlon pedaled up with the others just as if he belonged there caused her resolution, like her anger and her dismay, to grow apace. She thought reproachfully, as if Eddie were here and could listen to her, "You never told me that one of your friends was a nigger." Well, she thought, 20 minutes later, stepping into the hospital room where her son lay with his arm in a huge cast that was strapped to his chest, it hurt her heart just to look at it. She had sent them packing in jig time. No pun intended. None of them, except for the Denbro boy, the one who had such a horrible stutter, had had the nerve to so much as speak back to her. The girl, whoever she was, had flashed a pair of decidedly slutty jade's eyes at Sonia. From Lower Main Street or someplace even worse, had been Sonia Kasprak's opinion, but she had wisely kept her mouth shut. If she had dared so much as to let out a peep, Sonia would have given her a piece of her mind, would have told her what sort of girls ran with the boys. There were names for girls like that, and she would not have her son associated now or ever with the girls who bore them. The others had done no more than look down at their shuffling feet. That was about what she had expected. When she was done saying what she had to say, they had gotten on their bikes and ridden away. The Denbro boy had the Tozier boy riding double behind him on a huge, unsafe-looking bike, and with an interior shudder, Mrs. Kasprak had wondered how many times her Eddie had ridden on that dangerous bike, risking his arms and his legs and his neck and his life.
"I did this for you, Eddie,"
she thought as she walked into the hospital with her head firmly up.
"I know you may feel a bit disappointed at first. That's natural enough. But parents know better than their children. The reason God made parents in the first place was to guide, instruct, and protect."
After his initial disappointment, he would understand. And if she felt a certain relief now, it was, of course, on Eddie's behalf and not on her own. Relief was only to be expected when you had saved your son from bad companions. Except that her sense of relief was marred by fresh unease now, looking into Eddie's face. He was not asleep as she had thought he would be. Instead of a drugged doze from which he would wake disoriented, dim-witted, and psychologically vulnerable, there was this sharp, watchful look, so different from Eddie's usual soft, tentative glance. Like Ben Hanscom, although Sonia did not know this, Eddie was the sort of boy who would look quickly into a face as if to test the emotional weather brewing there and glance just as quickly away. But he was looking at her steadily now.
"Perhaps it's the medication," she thought. "Of course, that's it. I'll have to consult with Dr. Handor about his medication."
And she was the one who felt a need to glance aside.
"He looks like he's been waiting for me," she thought.
And it was a thought that should have made her happy. A boy waiting for his mother must surely be one of God's most favored creations.
"You sent my friends away."
The words came out flatly, with no doubt or question in them. She flinched almost guiltily, and certainly the first thought to flash through her mind was a guilty one.
How does he know that? He can't know that.
And she was immediately furious with herself, and him, for feeling that way. So she smiled at him.
"How are we feeling today, Eddie?"
That was the right response. Someone, some foolish candy striper, or perhaps even that incompetent and antagonistic nurse from the day before,
had been carrying tales. Someone. "How are we feeling?" she asked again when he didn't respond. She thought he hadn't heard her. She'd never read in any of her medical literature of a broken bone affecting the sense of hearing, but she supposed it was possible. Anything was possible. Eddie still didn't respond. She came farther into the room, hating the tentative, almost timid feeling inside her, distrusting it because she had never felt tentative or timid around Eddie before. She felt anger as well, although that was still nascent. What right did he have to make her feel that way, after all she had done for him, after all she had sacrificed for him? "I've talked to Dr. Handor, and he assures me that you're going to be perfectly all right," Sonia said briskly, sitting down in the straight-backed wooden chair by the bed. "Of course, if there's the slightest problem, we'll go to see a specialist in Portland, in Boston, if that's what it takes." She smiled, as if conferring a great favor. Eddie did not smile back, and still he did not reply. "Eddie, are you hearing me?" "You sent my friends away," he repeated. "Yes," she said, dropping the pretense, and said no more. Two could play at that game. She simply looked back at him. But a strange thing happened. A terrible thing, really. Eddie's eyes seemed to grow somehow. The flecks of gray in them seemed actually to be moving, like racing storm clouds. She became aware suddenly that he was not in a snit or having a poopy or any of those things. He was furious with her, and Sonia was suddenly scared, because something more than her son seemed to be in this room. She dropped her eyes and fumbled her purse open. She began searching for a Kleenex. "Yes, I sent them away," she said, and found that her voice was strong enough and steady enough, as long as she wasn't looking at him. "You've been seriously injured, Eddie. You don't need any visitors right now except from your own ma, and you don't need visitors like that ever. If it hadn't been for them, you'd be home watching the TV right now, or building on your soapbox racer in the garage." It was Eddie's dream to build a soapbox racer and to take it to Bangor. If he won there, he would be awarded an all-expenses-paid trip to Akron, Ohio, for the National Soapbox Derby. Sonia was perfectly willing to allow him this dream, as long as it seemed to her that completion of the racer, which was made out of orange crates and the wheels from a choo-choo flyer wagon, was just that, a dream. She certainly had no intention of letting Eddie risk his life in such a dangerous contraption, not in Derry, not in Bangor, and certainly not in Akron. Which, Eddie had informed her, would mean riding in an airplane as well as making a suicidal run down a steep hill in a wheeled orange crate with no brakes. But, as her own mother had often said, what a person didn't know couldn't hurt him. Her mother had also been fond of saying, "Tell the truth and shame the devil." But when it came to the recollection of aphorisms, Sonia, like most people, could be remarkably selective. "My friends didn't break my arm," Eddie said in that same flat voice. "I told Dr. Handor last night, and I told Mr. Nell when he came in this morning. Henry Bowers broke my arm. Some other kids were with him, but Henry did it. If I'd been with my friends, it never would have happened. It happened because I was alone." This made Sonia think of Mrs. Van Pret's comment about how it was safer to have friends, and that brought the rage back like a tiger. She snapped her head up. "That doesn't matter, and you know it. What do you think, Eddie, that your ma fell off a hay truck yesterday? Is that what you think? I know well enough why the Bowers boy broke your arm. That Patty cop was at our house, too. That big boy broke your arm because you and your friends crossed him somehow. Now, do you think that would have happened if you'd listened to me and stayed away from them in the first place?" "No, I think that something even worse might have happened," Eddie said. "Eddie, you don't mean that." "I mean it," he said, and she felt that power coming off him, coming out of him in waves. "Bill and the rest of my friends will be back, Ma. That's something I know. And when they come, you're not going to stop them. You're not going to say a word to them. They're my friends, and you're not going to steal my friends just because you're scared of being alone." She stared at him, flabbergasted and terrified. Tears filled her eyes and spilled down her cheeks, wetting the powder there. "This is how you talk to your mother now, I guess," she said through her sobs. "Maybe this is the way your friends talk to their folks. I guess you learned it from them." She felt safer in her tears. Usually when she cried, Eddie cried too. A low weapon, some might say, but were there really any low weapons when it came to protecting her son? She thought not. She looked up, the tears streaming from her eyes, feeling both unutterably sad, bereft, betrayed, and sure. Eddie would not be able to stand against such a flood of tears and sorrow. That cold, sharp look would leave his face. Perhaps he would begin to gasp and wheeze a little bit, and that would be a sign, as it was always a sign, that the fight was over and that she had won another victory. For him, of course. Always for him. She was so shocked to see that same expression on his face. It had, if anything, deepened, that her voice caught in mid-sob. There was sorrow under his expression, but even that was frightening. It struck her in some way as an adult sorrow, and thinking of Eddie as adult in any way always caused a panicky little bird to flutter inside her mind. This was how she felt on the infrequent occasions when she wondered what would happen to her if Eddie didn't want to go to Derry Business College or the University of Maine in Orono or Husson in Bangor so he could come home every day after his classes were done. What would happen if he met a girl, fell in love, wanted to get married? Where's the place for me in any of that? The panicky bird voice would cry when these strange, almost nightmarish thoughts came. Where would my place be in a life like that? I love you, Eddie. I love you. I take care of you, and I love you. You don't know how to cook or change your sheets or wash your underwear. Why should you? I know those things for you. I know because I love you. He said it himself now. I love you, Ma, but I love my friends, too. I think you're making yourself cry. Eddie, you hurt me so much, she whispered, and fresh tears doubled his pale face, troubled it. If her tears a few moments ago had been calculated, these were not. In her own peculiar way, she was tough. She had seen her husband into his grave without cracking up. She had gotten a job in a depressed job market where it wasn't easy to get a job. She had raised her son, and when it had been necessary, she had fought for him. These were the first totally unaffected and uncalculated tears she had wept in years. Perhaps since Eddie had gotten the bronchitis when he was 5, and she had been so sure he would die as he lay there in his bed of pain, glowing bright with fever, whooping and coughing and gasping for breath. She wept now because of that terribly adult, somehow alien expression on his face. She was afraid for him, but she was also, in some way, afraid of him, afraid of that aura that seemed to surround him, which seemed to demand something of her. Don't make me have to choose between you and my friends, Ma, Eddie said. His voice was uneven, strained, but still under control, because that's not fair. They're bad friends, Eddie, she cried in a near frenzy. I know that. I feel that with all my heart. They'll bring you nothing but pain and grief. And the most horrible thing of all was that she did sense that. Some part of her had intuited it in the eyes of the Denbro boy who had stood before her with his hands in his pockets, his red hair flaming in the summer sun. His eyes had been so grave, so strange and distant, like Eddie's eyes now. And hadn't that same aura been around him as was around Eddie now? The same, but even stronger? She thought yes. Ma, she stood up so suddenly she almost knocked the straight-backed chair over. I'll come back this evening, she said. It's the shock, the accident, the pain, those things that make you talk this way. I know it. You... She groped and found her original text in the flying confusion of her mind. You've had a bad accident, but you're going to be just fine.